I believe there's a picture in well, I think it was the Chemical Pioneer address of
right there. That yes, that's one of the later models. I should have dusted that off. Take a look at it. Take a look at the writing on it. One of my doctoral students of many years ago gave it to me at a party that half a dozen of them gave for me one time, and he made it and then gold plated it.
Mm. I'll have to take a picture of that later.
Yeah, okay. But that system then I used, and in the first months working with in the first months that I was with Eastman Kodak, I developed a tool for use with acetic acid, which tool had been used for the making of anhydrous alcohol years before. However, the tool had to be refined along some different lines in the case of acetic acid, because of course its properties are quite different from those of alcohol. And simply, this system of azeotropic, A-Z-E-O-T-R-O-P-I-C, distillation, depends on the fact that water and another liquid in which it is insoluble has has a summation of the partial pressures of the two, while if this other liquid is soluble in acetic acid, it does not have this same additive partial pressures. Substantially, what this means is that if you take a dilute solution of acetic acid, that is water and acetic acid, and add a material which is insoluble in the water but soluble in acetic acid, you can then lower the boiling point of water, which is 100 degrees Celsius, while acetic acid is 118. You can lower the boiling point of the water down to 50 or 60 or 70 degrees, say 70 degrees Celsius, and that then compares with the boiling point of acetic acid, which gives you enough spread between the two boiling points. Now the water at 70 degrees, the acetic acid at only slightly different than its original of 118, and that allows you to separate them by distillation column. This principle I devised and tried every imaginable liquid. The first one, of course, being benzene. Benzene was not regarded as the dangerous carcinogen that it is today, so I tried benzene, and then other materials, and each one we tried worked more or less. The benzene not too well, but every other one did, and so Kodak took out probably domestic and foreign patents, at least 30 or 40 patents on the work that I did in the first half dozen years, half dozen months there, because each one of these things worked and each one had some advantage or disadvantage. Meanwhile, Mr. Wilcox, who was the vice president of Eastman and the general manager at Kingsport, Tennessee, realized, and that is where the cellulose acetate would be made, he realized the necessity and of a process, because Eastman was interested at that time in developing safety film. The old film and the standard film was nitrate film, cellulose nitrate, chemically the same as, of course, gun cotton, and violently flammable or explosive. There had been one or two very bad incidents, one an X-ray vault in a hospital in Cleveland that had flashed or blown up or caused a very bad fire, and X-ray film was, of course, cellulose nitrate. The other danger was, constant danger was in the making of cellulose home movies. Kodak was trying very hard to develop home movies in the late 20s, and I myself, for example, played with home movies because the film and the projector and the camera were all made available to me as an employee. But if the projector happened to be wrong and the sprocket wrong and it didn't wind, I'd just let the film come out on the floor. Well, that might, and then I'd rewind it because I didn't want to interrupt my show. Is obviously a very great hazard. If you have a bushel of loose 8 or 16 millimeter, at that time it was all 16 millimeter film, on the floor, and somebody dropped a cigarette in it and it was nitrated, it'd go up. Kodak wanted safety film. Cellulose acetate burns, of course, but it burns no more rapidly than cardboard or so, and so therefore it's 100 times less hazardous than nitrate. And Kodak wanted to get into that business. Cellulose acetate was the only known material that could be used. The other thing was Kodak had its eyes down the road going into cellulose acetate fiber, and its competitor at that time was Celanese, and which had developed during the war. I might come back and tell you a couple of interesting things about Celanese, and that also would have required the handling of tremendous amounts of acetic acid, because you see, for every ton of cellulose acetate that is made, you would have to recover 4 or 5 tons of this dilute acid. So it was very, very important. Mr. Wilcox, as I started to say, looked at me in the laboratory my laboratory in Rochester one time in the fall of 1927, or late in the fall, and he said he was going to Europe to talk to people in Europe who had developed a process for this, because Kodak was interested in exploring all possibilities. When he came back, I had been working hard and had developed in the laboratory a way with the stills which I had devised for this pilot plant work of glass, and which we then expanded, of course, into much larger units. But he came back by the time I saw him next, probably in about the 1st of February of 28, and he again called on me in my laboratory and said that he had discussed this matter with this French company, who were very willing to license Kodak for the process. The down payment would be $1 million, and 1 cent a pound for every pound of acetic acid that was concentrated. Well, I told him that I thought I could concentrate the acetic acid for 1 cent a pound with the cost of steam and so forth, as it was in those days. He agreed that he was would put his chips on the processes which I continued then to develop. Do you want me to talk about Celanese, their background and how they happened to get into there?
If you want, you might as well.
All right. I'll spend 2 or 3 minutes. I never worked for Celanese until many, many years after, when I had an interesting assignment, maybe in the late 60s or early 70s, to visit the plant in Cumberland, Maryland, where they first went into the making of cellulose acetate. The process had been developed by a Swiss chemist by the name of Dreyfus, and he and his brother came to Washington during the early years of the First World War, just at the time when the airplanes were being used as fighters for the first time on any scale. Airplanes then were made of cheesecloth or canvas that was stretched over light wood structures, and in order to make them windproof, or so that they would support their lift with the air, they were covered with a lacquer made of cellulose nitrate, which was the only material that was suitable and light enough and so on for this purpose. And of course, the early pictures, which all of us remember seeing, of World War dogfights of airplanes, where there was an awful cloud of black smoke, and that was the nitrate burning the canvas of the and the wood frame, fuselage, and also the pilot, of course. So it was very necessary to get rid of the cellulose acetate and use something else, which Dreyfus, a Swiss chemist, had developed the system of making cellulose acetate. They came and talked to our War Department, who said, "You must come to work immediately. You must make cellulose acetate for us to coat our planes. We'll do everything possible to expedite." And so they came here, and the first consideration was, where do we put the plant? The plant must be a long distance from the coast. Why? Because in that day, time of the war, there had been flights that made our military think that the zeppelins would be bombing our eastern coast, which said made them so they decided to put the plant several hundred miles inland, a prime requisite for any such fiber operation is large amounts of water, not fiber in this case, a lacquer or a synthetic resin, was large amounts of water for washing and so forth, the materials, and that turned out to be Cumberland, Maryland, several hundred miles inland from Washington. So that was where the first acetate plant in the New World was built, and of course by far the largest one anywhere. And and Celanese then supplied the Allies from that plant with that material. Getting back to where?
Well,
you asked me.
You were working on the stills, and I recall a statement you made that it was the largest concentration of copper.
Oh,
I guess the stills became larger and larger.
I had various problems to solve. Fortunately, they didn't all come at once. The first one was, of course, the theory, which I was able to develop with little glass stills. Oh, I developed a fair skill of glass blowing, and I wanted to make a plate distilling column of glass. And I talked to German, can't think of his name, a glass blower, the professional glass blower. He said, Othmer, Dr. Othmer, no. What you show me is impossible. So I said, okay, I'll develop another kind. Mostly what I used were pack columns. I standardized on a 2-inch diameter pack column in 5-foot sections, insulated them with a standard pipe insulation, and put them together with rubber connections, either hose or corks, and build maybe 15 or 20 foot the heights of them. I also at that time developed the first of the multiple inner coil glass condensers, which have been used throughout the world ever since in laboratories. And in those condensers, the biggest ones, we have put on large pilot plants for condensing materials very pure. I'm rambling. I got away from my subject. You can't stop that for a second while I...
Well, we'll just cut it out later so we don't have to worry about it. Talk about the copper.
Yes, about the copper. My first copper unit was... the glass distilling column was a very nice design because it had plates and downcomers and so on, the same as a regular distilling column. And the glass blower refused to try it. However, in my, we usually took an hour or a little more for lunch, and instead of playing cards, as most of the fellows did from our after eating a quick lunch in the restaurants, of which there were three or four in Kodak Park Works, I went back to the laboratory and spent a half an hour practicing glass blowing, and it got to be fairly good. Only, of course, with Pyrex glass, which was... then we always had Pyrex and other glass. Nowadays, there's only Pyrex glass because it's so superior, although, of course, it takes so much higher temperature flame to work with, an oxygen flame. However, I then made one of the bubble caps with the downcomer assembly in a couple of noons, hours, and so on. And unfortunately, I didn't have any... oven to anneal it with, and I got a crack. The next time I saw the German glass blower, I showed him what I'd made. I said, "Well, this is fine, but I made it, but it has a crack." He said, "Well, if you could make it with a crack, I can make it without a crack." And so that encouraged him. And we then did make this particular distilling column, which of course was published in the old INEC, Industrial Engineering Chemistry, about 1932, I suppose, or 1931. But anyway, we made those up to 3 inches, a column diameter with a corresponding single bubble cap. One time we made one for one of the companies who wanted to use it under 150 pounds pressure. And that we took no responsibility, but said we thought it would stand that, and did make one, but it was only 1 inch in diameter, and presumably it worked all right. Although we've used them under vacuum, I've never personally worked them under pressure. We then jumped from those 2 inch columns to a 18 inch copper column. Which we had made, probably that was ordered in the fall, sometime in the winter of 1927-28 from the Lummis Company. The Lummis Company was in Boston, and Paul Lummis, the old man, he was then an old man, particularly compared to a youngster as I was of 24 or so, and I called on him in his drafting and engineering office in a loft off of Milk Street in Boston. And the Lummis Company did build that first column, and it worked. Did just what we thought it would with as a in trainer, ENTRAINER, which we called the material because it entrained or withdrew the water over the top of the column because it lowered its boiling point. That was ethylene dichloride. And ethylene dichloride boiled the water over the top at about 70 degrees, while the acetic acid at the bottom of the column was 118 degrees Celsius, and therefore there was enough spread so that a distilling column would work. We then ordered a 4 foot column from Lummis, and that had to have some special attention, and I decided that the still pot would be a poor circulation still pot because I expected trouble from the salt that was used. In those days, sulfuric acid in a small amount was used to help the acetylation of the cotton with the acetic anhydride and the acetic acid, and that material I expected to come down to the distilling column and cause trouble in scaling the heat transfer surface. So we got the Duriron Company to build the biggest Duriron pump they'd ever made, something that would be immune to acetic acid, and that was a 12-inch suction and 10-inch discharge to pump the liquid through the tubes of the heater for this evaporator or still pot. It didn't work just that way. When we fed the column, what I should have been able to foresee but wasn't able to was that the as the acetic acid become more concentrated, I forgot to mention that we had to neutralize the sulfuric acid to give us calcium sulfate or sodium sulfate, as the case might be, and so that was fed into the column. Well, the point being that the salt of the sulfate salt became insoluble in the acetic acid as it became more concentrated, because acetic acid is an organic solvent. It is not a good solvent for the inorganic salt. That meant that at some point in the column, all the calcium sulfate would come out as a scale. So the first time we operated the 4 foot distilling column, which had, I was very proud of. We had to build annex the building, and it was a rather expensive thing that we had put up And the column itself was very expensive because it was very heavy copper, and all the accessories with the silver condenser to condense the acetic acid. And what happened, it only ran a couple hours until the pressure at the base, we saw it was something wrong and the column was plugged. We had to tear the column all to pieces, was somewhat of a job, and take the scale out. The second time we did it, the same thing. We did it a second time. And then I saw that what was going to be necessary is we would have to distill the raw acetic acid, the 25 to 28 or 30% acetic acid, away from the salt before it got into the column, in order that there would be no salts in the column to precipitate out as the acetic acid became concentrated. Well, fortunately, I could take the one of the still pots that I'd had from my 18-inch column, which was in a building 100 yards away, and in a matter of a couple of days, we jerked that out and put it in alongside of the 4-foot column and fed the still pot of the 18-inch column as a pre-evaporator, so that we would evaporate and leave the salts behind in that evaporator, the same as any salting evaporator, and the vapor as it came overhead, we would not condense, but we passed directly into the distilling column. So that cost us nothing with regard to heat for that additional separating step. Well, that worked beautifully. And we ran that 4-foot column then for a long time. Meanwhile, getting ready and planning for utilizing this same process in Kingsport, where the manufacturing operations were to be conducted. This must have been by now, sometime late in 28, the planning for the operation in Kingsport was done in Rochester, and I worked with the engineering department in the design of these columns. Everything that Kodak did always was very, very conservative, and only the most rigorous attention to details of every kind, the use of very heavy equipment because of corrosion and so on. So the first units, as I remember, were 6 feet in diameter, and we planned 4 or 5 of them for Kingsport. We designed the building there in Rochester and the equipment, and that all then was used and did go on stream within a year or so. The distilling towers were made of very heavy copper. All the other parts were aluminum bronze. I won't go into the details of the tons and tons of copper that went in, the many tons of aluminum bronze castings, many tons of bolts that were used, because every single plate was individually flanged, something rarely done. The construction was 3/8 or 5/16 inch thick copper of everything, which was 6 or 10 times as heavy as copper weight as would be used in an alcohol column. And this sort of thing went all through. I designed the Wait a minute, no. No, the first condensers, the one for our 4 foot column, was made of silver. And I designed that to minimize the weight of silver, of course, but even so, it had 5,000 ounces, as I remember, of silver. That may be wrong. But anyway, it was a cage that I could get inside of. The tubes were 5 feet long and made a cage like a ending in circular headers at the top and bottom, and that then set in a tank of water, minimizing, as I say, the amount of silver.